大康自然健康中心成立于1987年，率先将自然疗法、同类疗法同埋碗肠水疗引进香港。我哋提供各项整全性治疗方式，排除体内毒素，增强自身免疫系统，一切尽在大康自然健康中心。电话25773798，网址www.naturalhealing.com.hk。
以下节目内容纯属主持及嘉宾个人意见，与本台立场无关。
First of all, welcome everybody, and I'm Dorothy. I'm one of the founder of the Body Mind Spirit platform. We are really grateful because this afternoon we actually have 8 experienced Body Mind Spirit trainers coming all the way to Dream Possible to share with us their expertise. And today actually is so important because our whole idea is talk about the best practice in this field. And also before we have started, we actually have invited our guests to consider some of the very important questions that we have in mind. And it's basically about how to combine the body, mind, spirit concept into the business world. As we all know, Hong Kong is really a very hectic, crazy business society. And a lot of us are working like crazy, hectic. And how can we balance our life? On one side, we can help our society to grow commercially, businessly, business-wise. But at the same time, how to maintain a body, mind, spirit balance. And that's something we want to dig their mind, you know, find out more about their wisdom on how to get a balance. And also how to combine and also fully utilize the society resources in order to bring in more body, mind, spirit to this society. And also at the same time, how to develop good quality body, mind, spirit trainer into Hong Kong. And another thing is very important is how to ensure quality, because body, mind, spirit trainer practitioners comes in different size, in different shape, comes from different part of the world. We have no idea where they are from. How can we ensure that the quality can maintain? And last but not the least is how to further develop the Hong Kong, how to awaken the majority of Hong Kong people or the citizens of Hong Kong people or maybe the business people in Hong Kong, the importance of body, mind, spirit. So let's give a round of applause to our guests, our three guests. But first of all, maybe we start with Julie. Yeah, okay. So Julie, all of you know Julie is an expert in expressive art. So I will give the time so Julie can talk a little bit about yourself and share with us your insight. Thank you very much.
Thank you. To be here. I was meditating on what to say, so I don't know if it's going to be as organized as I thought, because I lost the PowerPoint before I left the office today. So I'm trying to make it up now. How long do I have? 15? 20?
Yeah.
Wait, okay. I don't know where to start, but I'm just going to start with a very, very brief story of how I really believed in the product of art. What I mean by belief in the product of art is to truly be sold on the idea that art changes lives, that art can change people, that art can change individuals. Art can be art, and the arts can be an incredible source for social action, and it's a universal language. So I feel so deep about that, that it is in my soul. So anyway, I'm going to share a little bit about little snippets of the journey that I've had. as an arts therapist here in Hong Kong. But it started when I was very young and naive. I was living, living in America, and I was working with very underprivileged, very angry Afro-American community children, where every 30 minutes they looked at me, they called me a cracker lady, because white people don't have any substance. And I actually would hold the garbage can by the front door, because they would come by and say, I'm not keeping this junk, and they'd throw it in the trash. And I was trying so eagerly, you know, I'm there to save the world, I'm there to do good. And to make a very, very long story short, it was a place where I learned that stress kills. And I witnessed many, many things I'm not going to share right now. So I was starting to actually get a bit depressed myself. I'm like, this isn't working, and what am I doing, and I'm no good, and you know. So eventually I just really had an epiphany. We were going to be starting, I was the art teacher, yeah. We're going to be starting to study a unit on animals. And I thought, how the hell am I going to do this, you know? Because these kids don't really see animals. And it was really kind of ghetto area in southern Florida, Pompano area. I don't know if you know this area, along the railroad track. When I was driving to school, lots of people who would crack cocaine would come to my car and say, you know, why don't you come on in? I'm like, no, thank you, not now. And, you know, just trying to get to school. So it was really an amazing, hard event. And so I said, I got it. I got to do something different. This isn't working at all. And so I went to the principal, and I said, look, I'm going to take a group of kids to the Miami Zoo. And he said, hell no. We don't go on field trips. It's not safe. So I closed the door, and I slept on for 24 hours, and I said, no, I'm not taking that. I'm going in. Anyway, I insisted on going. So I took a group down to the Miami Zoo. There was only one fight on the bus, very little blood. We got there, and you know what we did? We sat there on the grass, okay? And drew animals. We just drew animals. I thought, okay, something's happening, right? So we went back to school, and I thought, okay, I need to connect with these kids, right? And so I knew that art regressed them. They were calling each other's names, they were snapping my crayons, they were calling me names, they were scribbling on the paper. I thought, wait a minute. I wonder if art can build them up. What does that look like? So that really was the seeds of me understanding it. And I tried to do dancing, like put on some like really cool music, and I was trying to do some dancing with them, and they're laughing at me. Rightly so, right? Like, that lady can't dance, you know, and they're saying lots of curse words, and I said, okay, All right, okay, I know I can't dance, right? I know I can't dance. Can you teach me? And we started kind of moving our booty in the class. And then I thought, okay, so they taught me a little bit. I said, you guys teaching me how to dance, I'll teach you how to draw. So I started bringing in all different kinds of rap music, you know, looking at, and all really cool, and it started to work. Eventually, we joined an art exhibition in southern Florida. Nobody knew who we were. No, we don't do exhibitions. Okay. Really, really, really. 3 years later, we won first place in all of Florida, our school. So they didn't even know what a superintendent was, but we put our artwork behind the superintendent's desk. He's like the big potato in education. I cried. Yeah, it's a long time ago. But that was the moment for me, like, and I didn't find art therapy, it found me, because there was a huge cut in the art funding, in which they always cut the arts first, which is crazy, but there's a huge cut, and I was then going to have to go every 30 minutes with art on a cart, right, and to semi-angry children. And I said, I can't do that. So I eventually found art therapy, where it found me. And I haven't looked back. And I graduated in 1994 from Florida State University. Worked in a psychiatric hospital for a year and a half. Moved to Hong Kong in 1994 or 5. And 25 years later, I'm standing here. So Santa, you and your group, well, I was very, you know, back in the old days, it was 1999 until 2001, I was coming to you guys and running groups, and so thank you for that opportunity. I'm just going to go through today and just highlight a little bit of the work. Really the support that I think of myself as a farmer, and I just put my head down and I just toil the land and I plant it, and basically that's really how I've experienced my whole adult life here, is doing that. And so it goes in different streams of support, or tiers of support. It's, of course, working with individuals and groups, kind of going in and basically pioneering it in NGOs for 25 years. Because when I first got here, nobody knew what art therapy was at all. And so I and there was another art therapist, we would go into the hospitals all over Hong Kong and give seminars free, and workshops to all the doctors and psychiatrists, and free. And don't give up your day job, because I was a teacher by day. I taught school, and as a teacher by day and therapist at night and weekends, and just started to plow the field, really. Now, just every minute planning and working on something. So we started having symposiums and workshops and trainings, and then it just started to grow. So I'm just going to share a little bit of highlights around that. And there's the clock, but I promise you there. I'm making this up. Okay, so I'm just going to talk for a second. So one of the things that I did, starting in 1996, was there's a very small group of us around, how are we going to get the word out? How are we going to do this? So we started having conversations about how forming an association. So I started to put my head down and worked really hard, learned so much, how to write a mission statement, what are we doing, gathering the committee together, what are we going to do. And so we opened up in 2002, but it was a four-year project. So I think earlier you were talking about how do we unite, form an association, body, mind, spirit association. I'll tell you what, it's the best way to, you know, cross-refer, because we got to help each other, right? We're all dedicated. We know we cannot separate the body from the mind, from the emotion. And when I'm working with people, like you're all working with people, I use the arts, okay? We use dance, movement, music, the arts. And I'm tapping all the time into all the energy channels between them, constantly, right? I if you use your intuition, which I'm sure everyone in this room is gifted with intuition, because you wouldn't be here if you weren't, because that guides us. We listen to our intuition. Okay, we have the knowledge. Okay, we study. Yeah, do study. It's a lifelong vocation. I don't think of it as a career yet, but to me it's a vocation. Okay? And we use our intuition too, because that will lead us the way. Right? And so I think forming an association is one really great way to collectively support the collective mission of what we're doing. Right? For me, art therapy doesn't own art. It's not, we didn't start the association to own art. We're all helping people using arts in different ways, right? One way is not better than the other. So in this, I started another stream called Art Facilitation Stream to work with probably a few thousand people, actually, in different NGOs and hospitals, Tonglong and the hospitals, Hong Kong Family Welfare Society, I'm not going to name them all, but to walk in and work with the staff and how they can use arts to help the people that they're working with. And I created some models to do that, and so we put our head down. It was a pretty serious program. It was for 9 months. But at the end of the day, they could confidently use arts to help. So I think what I like to think of it is to work on different tiers. You know, we work individually, but we help spread the word. We help train other people how to help people. Okay? And I think that's one way we can really do some powerful work collectively. In the association as well, we did relief work. I don't know if you remember I think I'll talk about that a little bit in a couple more slides. But through the association, we brought teams of people over to help. Also in education, using the creative arts in education, really a lot of very positive work, helping them healthy development, growth, build different kinds of their different, grow their different intelligences, really grow their creativity and imagination, and social skills development, and all different kinds of schools, local schools, special needs schools. So it's very much strength-based, and I think this idea about building creativity and imagination, what a gift. If you can give people the ability to access their own creativity, to see and experience themselves as a creative person. Right? I can create. I can think of new ways. I can think out of the box. So it's more than self-esteem. It's giving them that really incredible tool of being able to think their way out of the box and think of new possibilities. This is one kind of definition for art therapy. Right? We help people access their own creative inner resources to help them find new solutions in their life. Okay? I'm going to have you do something for me just for a minute. Don't worry, I'm not going to have you share. I want you to kind of keep your eyes open or closed. But I want you to think of a problem that you have right now. Okay. If I had you all day, we'd have a really incredible workshop on this. What do you see? Do you see a word like upset, U-P-S-E-T, or in whatever characters you might be seeing? Or do you see someone's face or a situation? Who sees an image? And that's why so many hands are going up. Because the human brain is designed to think in images. It is we're wired for that. So we help access the images. And I'm pretty darn sure, and I'm committed to the fact that if you can think of a problem, then you can think of a solution. It's more than possible. So I sometimes have some pretty fragile people sitting in front of me. They're more than stuck. That's the journey. Right? But it's not just the thinking part. How are you feeling about that problem? Really working through those emotions. And where do you feel it in your body? I also incorporate a lot of EMDR work into my work. I work a lot of people with trauma and abuse and lots of things. Happy things too. But, yeah. Okay, I assume I got this. Sorry about that. Okay, so relief work. I'm working with people. 5 minutes, great. I can do this fast. Tsunami survivors. Also working underneath tents with blowing wind and the blowing sand in our teeth. Working with post-traumatic stress disorder because of it. Bringing people back to make peace into the water. Human chains and lots of things. Also working with staff and teachers that had survived the earthquake in China. I'm going to speed up a bit, but so it's another tier of work. The elderly, I love the elderly, we all love the elderly. I've learned so much from the elderly, and I only have 5 minutes, so I'm going to keep it short. But it is such a beautiful joy to work with them, and to see them say, you know, I can't do art, I can't do art. You know, I call it cooking in the kitchen. I wrote part of a book on that. It's about collecting in the kitchen and throwing things at each other, like, you know, pinoir and all the things that they like, with dumplings and having them. They start off with collage, next thing you know, they're doing clay and painting. I can't do art, but they're doing it, right? Very, very quick funny story. I remember working in the NGOs, working with a lot of social workers because I like to work as part of a team. I asked this one gentleman to get me some brushes for this group. I'm working with people recovering from substance abuse and heroin addicts. This was a group for the guy-in for the family. So I show up, and I have these people getting ready to start the first session. And I see, they kept calling me, asking me, do you want large, medium, what size brushes do you want? I'm like, brushes, big, small, you know, just get them. And I show up, and there are 20 toothbrushes sitting on the table. So I'm demonstrating how to do art with toothbrushes. These people who thought I was just crazy. Anyway, it was, you know. Anyway, so you have to learn how to adjust to anything, because lots and lots of things don't go right. Social stigma. I often run, I hold art exhibitions. So I'm not going to go through all the pieces, but I'll just snap through them. And dealing with people need to understand that people are recovering and people are valuable. And so I think I got upset that I felt like there's a lot of social stigma when I was running my groups. So this really was a good platform for that. To go through their feelings of how they want to be, to work through their memories. And this is Toby, her very, very favorite cat. To work on working through feelings of not being understood when you're supposed to be happy in the family. And making stark connections to the self. I am valuable and accepting themselves. This gentleman, when he was talking about how he is starting to love himself, he was actually taking from the crayon.
Sorry about that.
And he... He was actually kind of tapping on the paper when he was writing. And he started rubbing it, touching it. So sometimes it's not what they make, but it's how they behave. How they behave when they're talking about it is also very important. A flower of love to myself. Mm-hmm. Goals of life. A lady who had a dream of becoming a flight attendant. And later on, her plan was to go to school and learn more English. And at the end of the day, she said, I might not become a flight attendant, but I do want to do something to do with flying. Mm-hmm. So I think it's having some kind of achievable goals, volunteering at the church, playing the piano. Ding dong. Mm-hmm. Magic. Something in his magic box. But actually, she came in the next session, I had her uncover the magic box inside, and basically it was her whole plan of saving money, one day going to school, and at the end she smiled really big and said, I want to get married. The whole group clapped. So it was a whole sense of social togetherness, the group supports. My favorite person, my guru, this person actually wanted to be a female Buddhist monk and had a lot of rejection from the family about it, but she is going to persevere. I love mother. A collective image of we are a bit fragile, but we're shiny still, and we are little ducklings coming over the hill, and please accept us. I want to end, give me 1 minute, with one beautiful piece of work that you've been doing lately over the last 7 years. Have been working with Joshua Helen Foundation. It's an organization by a very dear friend of mine who lost her son to a rare disease. So we work with kids with rare diseases and severe issues. Because sometimes kids who have severe issues actually have a rare disease that's not detected. It's arts therapy and expressive arts therapy. Believe in yourself, really believe in the product, and work collectively.
does such beautiful expressive artwork. And now we have our next guest, honorable guest, and maybe a little bit description. Kinsey is she has found the Hong Kong Heartbeat in 2001, and which offers everyday options for natural life in the fast lane. Interesting, right? Hong Kong Heartbeat encourage personal growth, responsible social development, and active public engagement. It also supports positive actions by connecting members to encourage sharing, collaboration, and cooperation. So let's give our round of applause.
Thanks. Like Julia, I probably don't need the mic either, but I'll use it. Thank you. I am so honored to be here today, and equally excited to be in a room where we can have this conversation. Seriously, I moved to Hong Kong in 1992 with Joshua Hellman's uncle.
Oh no!
I met Josh when he was 2 years old. And one of my highlights is meeting this little boy and his parents from Canada. And his first word was, "Aya!" I just so loved this little boy. And this is a real full circle moment for me because Hersha is one of my original Hong Kong Heartbeat members. I'm one of our greatest supporters. And when I first heard about the Joshua Hellman Foundation, it just made sense that I had founded Hong Kong Heartbeat. 2001, was that 17 years ago? And at that time, when I had moved here, I just remember talking to people about, I remember being out on a jump one day, and I was looking at the sky and the skyline, and it's so beautiful here. You don't have to look far to see beyond the buildings and see the, on a clear day, green mountains and blue sky and sparkling waters. And then my eyes kind of wandered down to the harbor, and I was like, oh my God. And I looked to the person next to me, and I said, like, seriously? And they said, well, if you don't like it, go home. And for 5 or 10 years, it was always the answer. I would raise any kind of concerns about the environment, whether it be water pollution or air pollution or noise pollution or light pollution or high processed food or unclean food. And people would say to me, they would look me square in the eye and they'd say, I'll just go home. So now I've been here for 26 years. People say, where are you from? I say, well, I'm from Hong Kong. No, where are you really from? Well, I was born in Canada. Oh, so now they know me. Ah, you're the expat who moved from Canada. And then I say, well, I was born into a farmhouse without running water, without, we had electricity, we had no hot water, we had no stove. My mom, we did a chopwood hot water. So we had a wood stove, no hot running water, an outdoor toilet, and my mom had a wringer washer. And then I lived in that house until I was 6 years old, and we lived in the middle of Canada on the prairies, where it gets regularly 30 degrees below. Well, minus 40 is the same. Keep close. That's Celsius or Fahrenheit. Go. Just minus 40 is the same they need. So long stretches of long winter. My mom had a baby, a one-year-old, a two-year-old, a four-year-old, and a six-year-old. And she raised all of her own vegetables. We had two cows out in the barn that we milked for the house. We had chickens that we raised for eggs, and another lot of chickens that we raised for meat. We had turkeys that we raised for meat, and one steer in the feedlot. Every fall, we'd get an ear tag, and that would be the one that would be going into our freezer, and everything else would be going to market. So I grew up thinking that I was poor because I had hand-me-down clothes. We didn't have a lot of money. I had the richest childhood of anyone in this room, and I think of anyone in this city. I now live in a small fishing village, and I feel more kinship with the granny and uncle, the auntie and uncle farmers, than I feel with the people who get on the ferry and go to the office every day. And I did that. I did that. I left home. I ran away from home because my dad doesn't believe in the education of women. It's true. I live now in a culture where that's not surprising. When I grew up, that was shocking. I literally did not speak to my father for 3.5 years while I was at university. I would come home at the weekends and teach my piano lesson. He'd go, "Oh, look, it's Miss University. So, like, really did not think this was the best thing because I would just be brainwashed. I was the first in my family to graduate high school. My two older brothers weren't really that interested, but they were also pulled out during exam time because they needed to be at the hardest. So when people look at me and they think they know who I am, I think, I'm not sure how I introduce myself so that you can meet the whole me and not just the story of the expat who went to university and met somebody and probably got married and moved to Hong Kong and has never had to worry about paying rent or buying groceries in the last 26 years. I had the great advantage of having a supportive family when I got here. They weren't my family, but they were a very supportive family in Helmand's. I lasted 3 months in that situation because I had chosen to come here with an addict. I realized, it took me many years to realize that I had made that choice because of my own history, because of my own experiences. Last October, during the Me Too movement, I decided to hashtag Me Too, and my family blew up. There's not always a good Me Too movement moment. I just happened to be at my parents' 60th anniversary when my Me Too post happened. And up until then, I was able to keep my secret from the community, like I had kept it in our family, very well. But because I was physically present, my family got suddenly worried that everyone knew, but everyone knew already. They just didn't talk about it in my family. So I came from this place of real, incredible richness, balanced with abject emotional poverty, and I was blamed, and to this day I am blamed because I spoke up. I am blamed my siblings, my parents, my brother's children now. I am blamed because I spoke up. So out of great richness comes great reward. So I spend a lot of time in victim. I could tell you this whole long story about how everything is everybody else's fault, and I've been evicted 3 times, and I've struggled financially, and I just can't seem to make my business work, but I've always had the choice to go back to that corporate world. I always have the chance to go back and be the headhunter who set up the regional broadcasting division in Asia. I could walk back and do that any day. I could go back and be in a senior VP position with any broadcasting company in Asia if I wanted to. I could be very senior in an agency. I could be very senior in-house in a marketing firm. I could be running an NGO. I could be doing any number of 9 to 6, which would probably be 7 to 11 plus the weekends. I could have any number of those jobs, and I'd have a part of my French, I would have a fucking good salary now. I would be making good money, I'd have great benefits, I'd be traveling, I'd be able to never have to think about when my friends invite me out for dinner, can I afford it? Never have to have that thought. But I chose in 1999, after an emergency back surgery, that I wasn't going back into that world. So I left that world, recovering from spinal surgery with complications. The HSBC had just given me a loan. I was so excited. I left that world with debt. the option of moving into a big company at that time was not really an option for me, because everything in my world was dollar what? It was 2000. I had no shortage of opportunities that I would have been giving my entire life, and I simply didn't have the physical strength to withstand the hours that would be required. So I always knew I wanted to start my own thing, never knew what I wanted it to be. So I decided I'd talk to my friends and say, well, I'm doing consulting now. Well, what kind of consulting are you doing? Well, let's have a conversation. Figure out what you need and I'll tell you if I can do it. And that worked really well for me in the early days, because I was still in the protector mentality. I was still very much in the system. And even to this day, there are times when it's like, I've been out of that system for 18 years, and I still wake up on a Sunday and go, oh, it's Sunday. Why don't I wake up on Thursday and go, oh, it's Thursday? Because there's no difference in my world. Thursday has no difference to Sunday. That system that we currently live in, that is currently starting to fray at the edges, holds us so tightly. It's really seductive. It's really addictive. It's designed to be that way. Otherwise, we couldn't have all of this stuff. We are required to be, we are institutionalized. So when we talk about food, we talk about institutionalized factory farmed food. I am never going to be a vegan or a vegetarian. I know what it looks like to humanely raise animals for home consumption. These hens milked cows for 10 years. That's why they're big. There are ways to live. There are ways to make choices every day. And I know that in my case, until I started really looking at what was underneath my choices, that I was finding it really hard to accept any responsibility for them. It's my mom's fault. It's my dad's fault.
It's my brother's fault.
It's my boss's fault. It's my neighbor's fault. It's somebody else's fault. And when I started to write, I remember it was a number of years ago when somebody, I was in a group because I'd had so many bad relationships. And somebody said to me, well, have you ever considered the common denominator in those relationships? Yeah, well, how about like you're the only common denominator? Oh, and it took me a long time for that to settle in, and that really was a very big first stepping stone for me to acknowledge that I am creating my reality. So I couldn't just go, well, I'm creating a perfect life from today forward, because a lot of the choices that I made in the past coming to fruition now. So not only do I need to make conscious choices today, I need to check in with when something's not going exactly right, instead of going, oh, fuck this, who did that? Like, oh, hang on a second, what choice did I make yesterday or last week or last month or last century that led up to this situation? Because it's always my creation. I made a decision when I started Heartbeat, and well, Heartbeat found me. I made a decision now that when I started sending out emails because people were asking things that I might have the answer to, that I thought, well, hang on a sec. Somebody's asking for meditation, somebody's asking for yoga, somebody else is asking for stealth. I'm seeing a common denominator. Not everybody could see that common denominator. But I just said, what if I answered everybody on one group email and gave them all the answers? So here's meditation, spell, and yoga. And if you want to be on the list, I'll just start doing this every week. Expecting people to just drop off and they go, oh, what a great idea. So I started writing every week, just here's what's on. I started getting on its email because it was 2001. So every week I'd write an email. Here's what's on. Here's what's new. Here are the questions that I've asked this week, answered this week. And if I didn't have an answer, I put the question on the list because somebody else would have the answer. So that's how Heartbeat was born in 2001. I knew how to do email. Didn't know how to do a website. I taught myself how to do a website. And I taught myself how to do the website after I produced a directory. So earlier in the session, some of the common themes that are coming up today, connection, collaboration, sharing. So In 2001, I launched a business in Hong Kong called Hong Kong Heartbeat. It's about connection, creativity, collaboration. Having given you a little bit of insight into my own personal history, it doesn't come as a surprise that I have really struggled with making this a business. Who am I to ask for money to do something that I love to do? Who am I to expect you to pay for that listing because I know you don't have a lot of money and I just really, really want to support you. I really want that to happen for you. So that's okay. I'll just do it for free. So I published in 2001 a directory. I printed 2,000 copies. I broke even on it. But in 2 weeks, they were gone because they were free. So I did it again in 2005. Printed 10,000 copies. Distributed them out. 2 weeks later, they were gone because they were free. And then in 2012, I did it again. I published 10,000 copies of the directory and I distributed them out. I went, oh, right, something's got to give. Over the past 10 years, I would say two things have happened in parallel for me. One, I've
dug pretty deep to find and heal the pain. That's not my brother's fault. It's not my mom's fault. It's not my dad's fault. I accepted that this happened. I accepted that I am this girl. I confused the hell out of my family by not keeping their secret anymore because it was really part of me standing up for me. And at the same time, I started recognizing that there is a value in this little business that I've created. And what's the secret to my success? Perseverance. That's the only thing. I've been to the last tribunal 3 times facing eviction. I've reached out to friends to the point where they just think I'm nuts for even continuing. If it's not making money, just stop. So I try to stop and I can't. I just can't. So now I go, okay, so where to from here? So I recognize that as I get stronger, my business gets stronger. I will not start a charity because the charity of Kinsey is officially closed. What I do, however, do is for every membership, so now I've created this membership model because I taught myself the internet and I do WordPress now. I figured out a way to comp an NGO for every paid membership. I'm real clear about what those membership benefits are so I can communicate those out to the potential members that I have 3,000 people on my database. There's really no reason for this not to be a successful business. I won't accept volunteers. I love NGOs that can take on volunteers. People say, get volunteers. I said, well, in a business, that's called slavery. And I'm really inspired to build a successful business that people look at that go, oh, that's possible. That really is possible. And money does 2 things. One, it helps us to get by in this world because, you know, the supermarket really likes cash. So does my landlord. But what it also does, it's a goalpost. It shows people. So like I can show numbers. I can show numbers of staff. I can show revenues. I can show expenses. And I can show that there's, you know, they're meeting closer than they ever have. And people start looking at possible. It's possible that people start saying, oh, maybe there is a business in conscious living. Maybe there is a business in conscious leadership. Maybe there is a business in conscious community. So having grown up in a place where you literally take your life in your hands when you walk outside the door, and community is absolutely essential for survival, I now live in an environment where community is 100% optional. We can go downstairs and find everything we need, and then we can get on a train and go as far as we want, and we can get on an airplane and then go even farther. There's no reason, physical reason, to connect with each other. So my vision for Hong Kong Heartbeat and beyond is to provide that community platform where people meet in the real, it's not a place where you go and you hook up with people. It's a place where you follow up with people after you've met in the real world. Or you look and you go, oh, Simon's been a member of Heartbeat for a long, long time, because I can see right on his directory listing, and I can look and see, oh, what kind of things are Simon, what kind of events are they hosting? So it really is about redefining how we see profit, how we see success, how we see our own success, and how we see the success of others. For me, my life shifted dramatically when I made a decision to wake up every morning and start my day with self-care. I make my cup of whatever, tea, coffee, whatever I feel like. Sometimes it's lemon. I burn a bundle of sage that I picked next to my sister's grave that I pick every year when I visit her. I write in my journal, and I'm not writing the captain's log. I'm writing what's coming up for me today. And then I'm pulling my two cards, sacred path cards. One is in Native American teaching, and one is companion animal. Because at the base of all of our shared experience is nature. And in this world that we live in, this system that's falling apart is a system that forgot that we are part of nature. You're not conquering nature, it's not a resource. We are part of nature, and that's the piece where everything's connected. So, in terms of what I see with the future of Hong Kong, I'm already seeing it. Because when I moved here in 1992, people would roll their eyes and say, go home. That hasn't happened in a long, long time. In 2001, I was very careful about who I even mentioned Heartbeat to, because when people would kind of look at me and look around for somebody else to talk to in the room. Now when I introduce Heartbeat, people say, oh, what a cool idea. And I think, yeah, I thought so 18 years ago. So to be present in this space where we're willing and ready and able to have this conversation, it excites me so much. And I now know that it's been a few years, 2012, it's been a few years, and I'm announcing spontaneously in front of you that I will publish a new directory this year, and you will find it in bookstores.
I really like the part where you said, you know, we cannot always rely on charity. Sometimes we have to consider making money in order to survive. Okay, now we have another guest, you know, and it's so interesting. And we have two guys coming up. And the next guy, Mr. Chong To, in his a little brief description, he's the founder of the Chi Han Foundation, and an NGO that sponsors the education and care of over 20,000 children whose parents have AIDS in China. And he is also being nominated as the 10 Future Leaders of China, and he's a visionary leader in the NGO field. So let's give our hand a round of applause.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm very honored and delighted to be here to share our stories with you guys. Thank you, Zhou Hua San, for inviting me. Actually, the Chi Han Foundation was co-founded by Zhou Hua San as well, and this is our 20th anniversary. So 20 years ago, a bunch of volunteers, including myself and Zhou Hua San, founded the Chi Han Foundation. Along the road, I came across, at that time, I was working with a bank called UBS. At that time, I also was planning to continue doing the volunteer work, but at the same time, have a full-time paid job. A few years down the road, I came across a group of children orphaned by AIDS in very remote area in China. And I decided to put aside my banking career and have become a full-time volunteer doing what I'm doing. In the past 16 years, we have cumulatively supported over 20,000 children in China through education sponsorship. And many of them have graduated and have become better in terms of their life and, most importantly, their psychosocial development. I came across this with a really... I did not plan on this career, and I did not plan on doing this. I came across a father and son. Both of them got HIV, and they were seeking medical treatment in Beijing. And I bumped into them, and because of my long-term curiosity and of HIV, I learned from them that many people were dying of AIDS in the area where they are from. And the reason is because many of them have sold blood for the past 20 years. In that part of China, people were very poor and very remote, and China was going through a stage of transformation. In the past, they were poor, but they didn't need a lot of cash. They had a shelter, and they were farmers. They have enough to eat. But China began to become more market-driven. So when the kids need to go to school, when they have family members who are sick and need to go to hospitals, when they want to buy a color TV, everything needs cash. But they don't have a lot of cash. Also, at that time, they also have to pay agricultural tax. So they they were stuck in very remote areas, and there were not that many opportunities to make a cash income. Many of them kept doing what they were doing in agriculture. Blood selling became a very popular way of making some supplementary income. So the whole village were mobilized by the government to give blood. And so they initially made some cash income. But due to unsanitary blood collection practices, many of them have contracted AIDS. By the time when I visited these villages, we went very late. Many of them have already died, and many of them were also dying. And at that time, the government was trying to cover up the situation. There was no medical treatment available, and a lot of them became even poorer than they before they sold blood, because they spent so much useless. I spent a lot of money on, you know, buying useless drugs, and a lot of people also trying to sell them not effective medicine. But I was most struck by the children, because when the parents died, these children became children orphaned by AIDS, and they will. I after doing so many home visits, I saw a sense of hopelessness in their eyes. So in the past, when I was at UBS, I also have been, you know, giving money to other organizations doing education work in China. I also made many trips to Yunnan and Guizhou, to poor mountainous areas. It is true that they're also very poor. They might have to walk an hour or two to go to school in very mountainous areas. But I saw that these children that I met before in mountainous areas, they were happy. Poverty did not make a very strong negative impact on them. At least they have parents, they have a complete communities. Illness, there wasn't a lot of illness impact, and most importantly, there wasn't a lot of social stigma. But the AIDS impacted villages that I visited in 2002 was very different. They were not just impacted by poverty. They were also impacted by the illness and social stigma. There were people who were just in the same county who would not dare to go to these villages, because it was similar to the case of leprosy in decades ago in China, there were villages of leprosy. And although the children of those who had leprosy do not have that, but when they left the villages to go to school, or they wanted to leave the village to get an education or get a job, they still got stigmatized. So many of these children do not have HIV, but they were so stigmatized by the neighbors and the schoolmates and sometimes by their own relatives that I sense that giving them money for an education is not enough. It takes a long and hard work to rebuild the self-confidence and do psychosocial development. So I want to share with you, although I'm the chairman of the foundation, we have spent cumulatively $300 million to support 20,000 kids. But I think the fact that 60% of them have gone to university, which is a very high rate. In China, the average rate of university succession rate is 8% for rural China. It's about 30-40% for the cities. But we have 60%, which is even higher than the average children in the urban areas. And of course, not everyone needs to go to university, so we have vocational training. But if our objective is to use education to give them a better development, I think the high graduation rate and the high university entrance rate is a very good indicator that we are very successful. And in these villages, traditionally, we're talking about 2-3%. That means if we have 100 kids in these villages, usually if you have 2 or 3 kids in the same primary school would make it to university, it's already something worth celebrating for. But then in one village we have 95 university students in a village of only 2,300 people. So we must have done something very right in order to create such an unusually high education rate. We make these children see the value of education and see the hope in themselves. So how do we do that? I'm more like a mentor, and our staff members also are more like the coaches and the mentors for these children. And I think we are not just giving them money, but giving them a sense of being part of the family. Many of our children have lost their parents to AIDS, so we hope that they can find a new family in Qiheng. And the reason why we can have such an atmosphere of a family also has to do with the fact that 70% of our staff members were actually previous beneficiaries that we supported. And after they graduated from university, they came back to work for us. So we are not just an organization for serving the AIDS orphans, but actually 70% of our staff are actually AIDS orphans themselves. So we are run and operated by the AIDS orphans. And I think that is an important factor. And another thing is our psychosocial development program. We have an art therapy program for 15 years. We have many volunteers and art teachers going to the villages and also in our summer camp to teach them art. And by art, it's not only drawings. It's also about singing and dancing and music. Because I think they may not be able to verbally express their trauma, but giving them art creation opportunities is a very good way for healing of their trauma. And also by teaching them to sing and dance, it doesn't have to be, they don't have to be, sing and dance very well, but the fact that they were able to do so would increase their self-confidence. So that is has been running for 15 years, and another important program is our summer camp and winter camps. We have in the past hosted over 200 summer camps and winter camps all over China, and over 5,000 of our junior high school students have participated. We believe that, and we focus on that age group, 12 to 16 years old. So basically, all the students that we support in that age group have participated in our activities. So it is not only just giving them money to continue to go to school. I think the summer camp is important because many organizations just give them money to go to school, but they don't see the value of education because they have never left their own village. At most, many of them have only been to the county town. And they have seen people older than the older people in the villages, and they thought that no matter how hard they study, this is the life, this is where they would end up. By bringing them to a big city in Beijing and Shanghai or other big cities, I think it opens and it becomes an eye-opening experience for them. And they could really see a very different world than their own in a very remote rural China. And by seeing that, we also bring them to a university for exchange. So it's very cool for them to go to a university and be able to experience a bit of studying and become a university student. And a lot of them, when they went back to their home village, they became a lot more motivated and study a lot harder because it seems something within reach to them. And at the same time, we kept telling them that if you this the world could be like this. It doesn't have to be a world in your own village. If you study hard, your life could be like this. I think in China, there's a saying that there is a golden villa in books. That means if you study hard, you can have a golden villa. But the problem is a lot of them have never seen this golden villa. They can only imagine what the golden villa is. But if you bring them to see a university, go to a big factory, go to a big city, after seeing this golden villa, they became more motivated because they now have an objective in life to achieve. And the last psychosocial development that I want to share is our Big Brothers and Sisters program. Every year we mobilize our university students that we sponsor to become our volunteers, go back to their home village, to become the tutors and the mentors for the younger kids. And they would do home visits, visiting them at their home. And it's very inspiring and empowering when these university students tell the younger kids that they now are now in university. They are also from the AIDS impacted families. And don't worry, if you study hard and don't give up, you can be like me. Because if we do the same work, they may not see the future. But when they see people who are just a few years older than they are, coming from the same community, who's now become a university student, I think it is a lot more convincing and empowering for our children to inspire them to motivate. So these are the few psychosocial programs of our work, and I believe this is the key to success, not because we just have money to send them to school. In every stage in their development, they stay in school and become psychosocially in better condition because of these. In the last 3 minutes, I want to share with you about my personal journey as well. After I began this work, I was really not prepared to see so much human suffering and the trauma as a white collar banking person. So by going to such remote areas and seeing so many people dying, it's really it's traumatic to myself. So 3 years after I started doing this, I became on the verge of depression. I never I started to wake up in the middle of the night and started crying for no reasons. I started to have nightmares. I became self-aware of the problem. So I have never seen a doctor, although I have been having coffee with friends who are doctors. I've never been on medication, although I ate a lot of chocolate, which is a natural antidepressant, I was told. So I came out of this, and also I came out of this also because I started also practicing meditation. I have been to a few Vipassana camps, and a lot of the negative feelings and experience that I suppressed also came out. So that was if we have more time, share how to uplift the children from AIDS orphans to better developed is one story, and how to uplift myself is another is another story as well. But the last 1 minute, I think I have met a lot of people about my age who sold blood and have died. They were equally, if not more so, smarter than I am, and hardworking, if not more so than I am. But they just did not have the opportunity that I had. So once I realized that a lot of what I have has to do with how lucky I am, that I had the opportunity for education, I had the opportunity for employment, I became more humble, and at the same time, I became more socially responsible. And I have decided to use my fortunate life to help those who are less fortunate. And I also want to share with more people that actually that many of us may not realize that we already have enough to sustain ourselves, but at the same time, unfortunately, many of us still pursue more wealth. And Chiheng, I met a lot of people who are poorer than I am, but they are very happy. But at the same time, I met a lot of very wealthy donors who may not be very happy. So I think I have decided to pursue happiness rather than wealth, and at the same time, I encourage more people to do so as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. I think you should put out a piece of paper for people to sign up to your volunteer program, right? Okay, so our last speaker, last but not the least, okay, Mr. I hope I pronounced it right, Mr. Danny Kuzigara. Danny is the co-author with Jack Canfield. I think most of you heard about Chicken Soup of the Soul. He's the co-author of the bestseller, and he also is one of the most highly sought after coaches in Asia, and is named a top 100 authority by Influence Magazine. Danny's expertise lies in helping the corporate leaders in multicultural environments to create a cohesive peak performance work culture and a team that share a common vision. Now let's give our last
Thank you very much. I'm a very humbling company today, so thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me here. I've been to Dreams Possible, I think now 3 times or so, and it's always been a pleasure coming back. Sometimes I see familiar faces, and sometimes I see not. and sometimes I see very new people, so thank you for having me. So, as I was introduced, I'm basically the founder of Freedom One International, executive coaching and business consulting. I do business transformation work. I help basically corporate leaders and business owners try to help them double their income and their time off in 2 years or less in both business and life, because I believe both are intertwined. You can't have one and not the other. I'm also now on the advisory board of a sensational consultancy that provides employment for disabled people. I think disabled people are not getting the right opportunities for employment in this environment in Hong Kong, so we are trying our best to liaise with the government as well as various other corporate enterprises to have a fixed quota for disabled people to have employment as well. So I started some of these initiatives, and I also run a Train the Trainer program where I help certified people become executive coaches or life coaches and start their own businesses as a new career, because I think this is, as Angela mentioned, I think we really need more people in this field who can do some good work in corporate environments as well as in businesses. So I've been in this field for now quite a long time. Prior to this, for the last 18 years, I was in the banking industry, like yourself. I was Chief Operating Officer and Chief Financial Officer for Royal Bank of Scotland across Japan, China, Philippines, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. So that's given me, I believe, a lot of experience that I bring into my coaching environment as well, because I kind of resonate with what people are actually going through. Whether it's a personal challenge or whether it's a professional challenge, you can actually, resonate that with your own personal experiences. It makes it more effective, I believe. A lot of people ask me why I got into this profession and didn't pursue my own banking career. Like I said, I can always go back. It's not a problem for me. I enjoy it. But what really shifted me, and I think some of you have probably heard my story before, is that back in 2010, when I was posted in Hong Kong from the Philippines, although I had a lot of material success, I wasn't feeling very fulfilled. I felt that there was a little bit more to life than I was giving, and my talents and actual abilities were not being, fully utilized in developing the human potential. So one day I was going out, going back to home from work. Usually my wife used to pick me up, but one day she didn't. She was probably doing shopping, whatever. And I took the minibus back home, and I was living on Kennedy Road at that time, and there's a church on the right as soon as you go up to Kennedy Road, and there's a banner that says, "Ask and you shall receive." Next morning in my meditation practice, I asked this question: what is it that I need to ask, and what is it that I need to receive? So the first week, nothing happened. Second week, nothing happened. Third week, nothing happened. Eventually, nothing happened. One fine day, I was in a bookstore in ICC. It's called Metro. It was a much bigger bookstore then than it is now. And I have three daughters. I took my three daughters there. And many of you might know, I'm not a big fan of books. I'm more into movies. So I was getting a little bit bored, waiting for my kids. And I started hovering around the spirituality section, looking for a book by Deepak Chopra. And while I, pulled his book out, another book fell on the floor, and I picked it up. It was called Secrets of the Light. It was by a guy called Daniel Brinkley. I turned the book around, and it was about someone who had NDEs, near-death experiences. I found it really interesting. He was on HBO, he was on Larry Live, a movie was made, he had a bestseller. I said, wow, this is pretty cool. So while I'm waiting, let's just sit on the floor and start reading the book. I started doing that about... It was so amazing that I was sitting on the floor reading the book, and suddenly a security guard was staring at me, and this guy says, "Going to read and run away." But there was something in this book that really caught my attention. So I bought it, read it in 2 days, and I decided to call this guy up. I found his number from a friend who lives in Los Angeles, and I remember Hong Kong, 7 a.m. in the morning, I was calling him, and I was thinking, what am I going to say? This is Danny from Hong Kong. Who the hell is he? What does he want? And he picks up the phone. I say, "Hi, Danny. My name is Danny." And he says, "I was waiting for your call." And when he said that, I had these goosebumps all over me. And I said, wow, this is something real. And I was expecting to speak to him for about 10, 15 minutes. We spoke for about an hour and a half. And the crux of the conversation was that I had to do something bigger and something better than what I was doing now. Which is why I went on this journey. I worked with Jack Canfield, etc. And I had my own purpose, which is to inspire and empower others to become successful and happier in business and life. This is what I do now. So I found this incredibly powerful. And in, back in 2004, I read a book called The Power of Focus. And this was about when they interviewed about 2,000 senior executives, business owners, spiritual practitioners, in what makes people super successful or real high achievers. What's the difference? So three things came out of it. The first thing was they have unusual clarity about their purpose. Their purpose, passion, vision, and goals are always in alignment. They are at a higher vibration, they're always in alignment. Number two, they have very powerful success habits, or what you call disciplines of success. You know, incorporating a new habit every day or once a week, you can really change the paradigm of the way you think. If you have, you know, if you incorporate just one success habit a week, you have 52 success habits, new success habits in a year. So that's a big shift. And the third one was they take 100% responsibility for the quality of their lives and their action-oriented. When I went through these things and I started incorporating them into my own life, I saw major shifts happening. In 1 year, I got 2 best-selling books out. I co-produced an Emmy-nominated movie called Soul of Success. And a lot of new things came. I always wanted to do a TED Talk. I went on TEDx. So I found that when you're in alignment with what you're meant to do, opportunities and people start presenting themselves to you. And this is very powerful, I feel. But the one thing that I find which is really, really, really important when it comes to success is emotional success. And which is why when Santa asked me, what do you want to talk about? I said, it's emotional success. Because based on my experience and when I work with clients and people or in public events, what I find is that when you're emotionally aligned with the thing you want in your external reality, it comes more easier and more faster to you. So being emotionally aligned about the thing you want is really, really, really important. Whether it's a new relationship, whether it's better health and well-being, whether it's just more money, whether it's a new business. So whenever you're emotionally aligned with the thing you want, your success comes more easily and more faster than you would have thought it would come. So that's why I believe, you know, in a society like Hong Kong, emotional success is really, really important. Because when I do public seminars, I find that there's a lot of emotional disparity or misalignment with what people actually want and how they're feeling inside. And there's such a big mismatch that the struggle continues on and on and on and on. So the fastest way to get to what you really want is to align yourself emotionally. A few years ago, I was in a seminar, and a guy who was going to be a speaker was a guy called Kenneth Bering. Kenneth Bering wrote a book called Road to Purpose. And when he got up on stage, I really liked his story, which is why I remember it. He was a billionaire. Thank you. He was a billionaire. And he said that he was not very happy or very fulfilled in life. So he said, probably I'm not happy because I don't have enough stuff. So he goes and buys a bigger house, a bigger plane, you know, a nicer car, a new house, but he still doesn't feel happy. So he says, maybe I need more stuff. So he gets another plane, another house, another, you know, all the trappings that you have of a billionaire, but he still doesn't feel happy. So the third thing he says, maybe I need different stuff. So he goes and buys the Seattle Seahawks football team. So he still wasn't happy. So one fine day, a friend of his calls him and says that he's going to Eastern Europe to deliver wheelchairs to children whose legs were blown off in the Bosnia War. He says, that sounds pretty good, let's go with it. So he goes there, and while they are handing out the wheelchairs to the children, an 11-year-old boy holds his leg and doesn't let go. The boy starts crying and he says something in a language that he doesn't understand. So he calls an interpreter to interpret what the boy was saying, and the boy said, "Please don't go yet. I want to memorize your face so that when we meet again in heaven, I can say thank you one more time." And he felt that that was the moment where he realized what his purpose was. So since then, he's been a happy man, and he donates 400,000 wheelchairs every single year. So that's the power of knowing your purpose, and I really encourage people to really get deeper into that. Now, what are BMS practitioners, coming back to one of the questions you were asking of BMS practitioners, in my opinion, I believe that for BMS practitioners to be very effective, I think we can create three things. We need to create more awareness in Hong Kong. Secondly, we need to challenge some old beliefs that people have and replace them with more empowering beliefs. And number three is to create a more happier community. People where people can feel safe to take action, where people feel safe to be themselves, and create an environment where people feel that they can speak out what they want to speak out. And there are many ways you can do this. Recently I wrote a book called Inside Out, 8 Success Keys to Helping Millennials Thrive. And one of the purpose of that book is to change the way education learning is happening in educational institutions. Because if we can influence the youth, if we can influence educational institutions, the change becomes much faster and more easier, as opposed to talking to people who are already in a midlife crisis. So I find that, you know, working with younger people, education institutions, and even, you know, the millennial generation, we could drive change through this, you know, this BMS society that we're trying to form. I think it's a very, very good initiative. And I think we should help people move away from fear, move away from negative thoughts, move away from blaming, complaining, and making excuses, and getting more into, you know, life visioning, getting more into taking inspired action, getting more into mindfulness. I think mindfulness is really, really powerful. I just did an event for the Louis Vuitton group in Japan, and part of it was mindfulness, and I was really nervous. I didn't know how 80 employees would view mindfulness, like sitting there and meditating in a corporate environment, but they loved it. So things are changing. The energy is shifting as well. So I think we shouldn't feel shy about it. Just go out and do it because we believe it's the right thing to do. Thank you very much.